Good morning. The nation's obsession with Roy Keane continued this week. What Roy did, what Roy did next. But seriously, where else on the planet would you get that kind of buzz and excitement over the appointment of an assistant soccer manager, however beautiful? But of course, Roy Keane is pure box office. 150 journalists togged out for his first news conference in Malahide on Wednesday, and he didn't disappoint.
I think to spell it out, I'm there to assist him, to help him in anything he wants, whether taking a training session, going to watch players, sometimes doing the media. So I think that will help me, that I know what it's like on the other side. I know how hard it is when you're a manager and, you know, disappointing players by letting them out. And hopefully my role will be, like I said, to assist Martin, help him in any way I can. And that's my job. That's the role I've got. So to question what happened previously or why it might happen in the future, it's almost irrelevant. To just focus on the now. We've had a lovely few days. The hotel's been lovely. Food's been excellent. Training ground is lovely. No potholes. We've had footballs. It's been great. Bibs, everything. It's been major progress.
And it was clear Roy's enjoying being part of the Ireland setup, back in the thick of it.
You know, there's obviously that mutual respect between each other anyway. So, but I know my role and they know what that is. And that's, you know, to try and help the team to be focused and ready. So that's been good. I've enjoyed I've missed having a bit of crack. I love football chat. So we've had the last couple of nights, good crack with the staff and the players and... No, but I miss that side of it. I have to say that's one of the real pluses, getting back into football chat, and even having, you know, a chat with some of the players one to one, which I've done. It's been good. Really enjoyed it.
Roy Martin joked last week that he would be bad cop and you would be bad cop.
I think it's going to be the other way around. I think I'm going to have to be the good cop. You obviously don't know Martin as well as you think you do. He makes me look like Mother Teresa. You know, he's that should be interesting.
Roy Keane, all sweetness and light, heard on Drive Time with Mary Wilson on Wednesday. However, sources close to the rumour tell me that there was some tension with Mick McCarthy at the Aviva last night, shortly before kick-off against Latvia.
Oh, I'm pretty confident, Roy.
Yeah.
I feel sure we'll get a result. You've been brilliant, by the way.
Oh.
I thought you might have got a bit annoyed when some of the lads were messing at training.
Well, I'm a different man now, Martin. You know, I'm calm, I meditate, I do yoga, I study Buddhism. All that anger is in the old... Oh my God, look who it is.
Oh, Martin. Hello, Roy.
Oh, how about you, Mick? Are you okay, Roy?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Hello, Mick.
Oh, so it's all going well then?
Yes.
We've all put Saipan behind us.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Of course we are. Huh. Yeah, we're all a happy family now.
Well, it's all going well with Roy, Martin. Or...
Oh, sure. You know, we're getting on like a house on fire. better call the fire brigade.
Oh, well, I'm sure Alex Ferguson was wrong when he said Roy was acting like he was the manager.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Oh, that's very funny, Mick. What do you think about that, Roy?
Oh, that was a good one, Mick, yeah.
Well, I'll be off managing Ipswich these days. Forgot you were there for a while, weren't you, Roy? Did they send you home as well? See us, lads.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. You're a crap player. You're a crap manager. The only reason any deals with you is that some of you are the manager of my country, and you're not even Irish. You English You can stick Ipswich up your box.
Well, it was very nice to bump into Mick again.
Yeah. He's looking well, isn't he?
How long till kick-off now?
Oh, about half an hour.
Oh.
Fancy cup of tea?
Yeah.
Maybe a butterfly bun or something nice. Yeah. Like something sweet, you know.
Roy, are you all right?
Yeah, feeling good. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Oliver Callan from Callan's Kicks last night. The people of the Philippines are well used to natural disasters, but it's the scale of Typhoon Haiyan, the 25th storm of this season alone, roaring across the country at 270 kilometres an hour, that was overwhelming, and the television images of the devastation have shocked the world. Thousands are believed to have died, many are homeless and without food or water, and rescue workers are struggling to reach remote areas. For the Filipino community living in this country, waiting for news of their loved ones has been particularly harrowing. Morning Ireland reporter Cathy Farrell spoke with Jamie Casaban on Tuesday. He's been working here as a chef in Dublin for the past 9 years, but is originally from the coastal city of Tacloban, which has been virtually wiped out. Jamie finally got news from his sister in Manila that 10 members of his extended family have been lost.
Even last night, I can sleep properly. You know, I can't sleep well because I'm thinking, I'm sleep praying. Hopefully, only the material thing is gone, even the house, I don't care. But when I called to my sister this morning in Manila, I heard very bad news that she told me at the moment 10 of my relatives is gone and the rest is missing. Damage is done, everything is happening now, so that's it. You know, kind of water is like a tidal wave, like a tsunami in Japan, more than. The water in my country is 25 feet, something like that. This is absolutely devastating. Every time I see the news in my country, I see the picture, oh, Jesus Christ. The part of the Tacloban, the island where I was born, is like erased on the map now. The people is walking like a zombie, like a dead. Everything is devastating. Very, very sad. Very, very sad. My sister, when I talked to him this morning, is crying. I tell him what I'm supposed to do. And I'm still praying to God to give him strength. That's it. Nothing. That's the part of the life. And I know everything have God's plan. Everything happened, I have God's plan.
And how is your sister coping?
My sister, she told me the most important now is a financial support. That's it. I tell him, yeah, I know. I try to do my best about that. To buy food, to buy clothes, to buy, you know, temporary build a shelter as a temporary. Because nothing now and there is so sad. The first thing can do is to pray to God to give him a strength for my relatives over there now. And the second thing is to send the financial support. That's what we have now. Because I'm thinking, even if I go back home, the plane ticket is the cheaper, 600, 700, 1,000 euro. If I send that in the Philippines, it's a lot of money for that. So that's why I'm thinking, instead I'm going back home, I send that money for to help for our relatives over there, because that's what she wants at the moment now, financial support.
From Tuesday's Morning Ireland, a major international relief effort is now underway, but the distribution of aid has been painfully slow because of the scale of the devastation. Channel 4's chief news correspondent Alex Thompson was one of the first journalists to go out on a relief mission with the Air Force, and he told Áine Lawler what he saw on Tuesday's News at 1.
I've been spending the day really going up in two helicopter sorties with the Philippine Air Force. The first drop we did was sacks of rice. We landed on a beach about 5 miles out from the provincial capital here, and it was an extraordinary sight. We couldn't land at first because there was a danger that these people were going to get in the way of the helicopter landing. Eventually they got the message, organised themselves, pulled back. We went down, hit the beach, and people came running to grab these sacks. These are hungry people. These are frightened people. These are confused people. But they are ultimately very relieved people to have seen what appeared to be, and the air crew said it was the first aid that had got through to this area since the typhoon happened. Then about 3 hours later, we went and did a mountaintop drop. The terrain there is so steep they couldn't actually land the helicopter. They just floated and hovered 3 or 4 feet above the ground and basically threw and kicked out, not flour this time, but bottles of water. And these mountaintop communities have been left really badly, devoid of fresh drinking water. I can't tell you how remote the terrain is. I mean, these are tiny little communities of totally destroyed wooden houses, very exposed to the elements. And there is another typhoon which may well track across this area. It's due to make landfall in the next 2 days.
It's believed 9 million people have been affected by this disaster, many of them children. As Peter Power of UNICEF Ireland told Fran McNulty on yesterday's Morning Ireland, Peter is on the ground in Cebu.
There are children now in Tacloban who have been without food and without water now for many days. We're hearing reports of children scavenging amongst dead bodies looking for food. It's been that horrific, Fran. And it's getting worse rather than better, because the more that these children go without clean water, our food, our medical supplies, the more they are prone to injury. There are a lot of child protection issues because a lot of children have lost their parents. They've been separated from their parents. They're in a very, very vulnerable situation.
Amid the chaos, medical teams are working flat out to treat the injured, as Christopher De Bono explained on Morning Ireland.
We're very fortunate that we have doctors and emergency specialists who are very skilled at this, and unfortunately who've done it 100 times before. basically what happens is you throw yourself in, you ignore sleep and you get everything else for the first week. And then at the end of that, you burn out and someone else comes in and takes over from you. I don't know what else to say, but when you know that children's lives are what you're working for, it's a lot easier to stay focused and stay awake.
RTÉ's Paul O'Flynn has been reporting all week on the relief effort. He's on the ground in Cebu with Irish aid workers, and he filed this report yesterday.
The bulging sacks of food are loaded onto a pickup truck and taken to the port for shipping. With the help of Irish aid agency GOAL, the food will reach those most affected by Typhoon Haiyan. James Kelly is a member of GOAL's emergency response team in the Philippines. He says the priority is to get the aid to those who really need it.
Power has gone down. Up until recently, there was no way of getting any aid in. But now it's food, water. Shelter is obviously very important for people at the moment. A lot of houses we've seen in this area have been completely destroyed, so we need to get some plastic in for shelter for the rains that are coming in the next few weeks. And then some medicine, some medical aid would definitely be needed, some basic aid.
Another Irishman doing his bit is Father Aidan McMahon of the Redemptorist Order. Originally from Listowel in County Kerry, he's lived in the Philippines for 35 years.
I'm just helping here in Cebu to coordinate with the different groups in Ireland. And already the response has been terrific from Ireland, so thank you very much to the Irish people.
He says he's used to seeing the effects of typhoons, but this one was the worst ever.
This morning, one of our guys who went over yesterday, he went around just the local area and there were 35 bodies just in that area, still uncollected, still lying there on the street. People are hungry, they need water. It's slowly getting there, but it's frustrating that we get aid from Ireland and you can only get it so far, and to get it to Tacloban is difficult, or to any of the other villages and towns, it's very difficult.
RTÉ's Paul O'Flynn reporting from the Philippines, and needless to say, donations are badly needed. You'd think that tragedies like that would put our own troubles into perspective, but it's all relative, and the difficulties some people are facing since the collapse of the Celtic Tiger are stark. On the business, George Lee spoke with Chris Lahan. Chris is the official assignee for bankruptcy, and he's preparing his office for a huge increase in bankruptcy cases as the new personal insolvency legislation takes effect in the next week or so. George asked Chris about the human side of bankruptcy.
In terms of the mental state of some of the people that you've come across, I presume some of them are very fragile indeed.
Absolutely. I mean, I have had people in who have shown me scars.
Where they've tried to damage themselves.
Almost as, in a way, a threat that in pursuing and trying to ask what are legitimate questions in bankruptcy, push me any further and I will go beyond where I've gone before.
So threatening to kill themselves if you go any further.
Well, situations.
Has that happened?
There has been one instance at an early stage. I'm 5 years in the official assignee, where an individual unfortunately did take his life. I can say that it wasn't through pressure of us. It was a historical bankruptcy, so there was no kind of immediate pressure from us. But it certainly does leave you that when you're thinking and you're discussing personal finances with people, that there are people out there who really are very vulnerable. They've had a huge, I mean, an awful lot. Irrespective of how far you've fallen, relative to everybody, there's some people who were tradesmen, who were speculators, who were worth millions. And then there are people who were worth maybe billions who have fallen. So the impact, I think, with some can be quite acute.
And George wondered if the public is right to be sceptical about some of the well-known individuals who have entered the bankruptcy process but still seem to be able to access some funds.
Tom McFeely, there's a story about him in the Irish Independent, who is bankrupt in this country, and he avoided jail again, according to this story, with Dervil MacDonald, because he was able to, or somebody paid off a €24,000 bill which he had in relation to a company which was suing him. How is, it says actually specifically in it that funds cannot be distributed from Mr. Feely's estate without the authorisation of the official assignee, Chris Lahan, but it's not known whether or not you've got any reaction or whatever to that. How can that happen if a man is bankrupt that he's able to pay off €24,000?
OK, well, without talking about particular individuals other than if you want to talk about that individual, there's already been a query gone from my office to the people who've received the funds, and we will be looking at all aspects of that. There are certain situations where people are not cooperating with me, and the full rigour of the law will be applied to those individuals.
Chris Lahan with George Lee on the business. Well, the big news here, of course, this week was the government decision to exit the bailout without a credit line. On the gathering yesterday, Sean O'Rourke discussed the implications with economist Jim Power, RTÉ's industry correspondent Ingrid Miley, and barrister Aileen Hickey.
We're out of the bailout, or at least we're on our way, minus the parachute.
Yes, I suppose a three-year period has ended. I'm not sure it's of anything more than symbolic importance, because the troika leaves on December 15th. We're not going to look out the window on the 16th and see a whole changed landscape. We're left still with a massive legacy of debt, you know, $202 billion at the end of this year, 124% of GDP. We're left with a banking system that's still dysfunctional. We're left with a personal mortgage crisis that has still not been addressed.
But so
nothing is going to change.
Ingrid, what are you most worried about, if you are worried?
Well, I'm always worried. I just lie awake thinking about really boring things like the pensions crisis and what have you. I mean, I am the most boring person on the planet. But I suppose I worry...
That is not why you're here, Ingrid Miley.
Okay, right. Okay, I'll try and be interesting. Now, for me, I suppose, and I'm speaking in a personal capacity here, I don't know if the banks are really sorted. I don't know if there isn't still an unexploded time bomb there in terms of the mortgage crisis. We still haven't sorted the unemployment crisis. Jobs are still being lost. I'm hearing rumours about, you know, job losses this afternoon at a big plant. You know, those people will almost inevitably, if they can't get another job, have difficulties with their mortgages. The other thing that really worries me is that all of the recovery predictions are predicated on growth, both here and in Europe.
Aileen, to just assuage Ingrid's fears and worries that keep her awake at night, Michael Noonan has said that he doesn't believe there are surprises in the banking system. And he's talked about this exit amounting to getting our freedom back.
Yeah, which would seem to be a bit of a gross exaggeration. I mean, I just, you know, again, like Jim said, I don't see what difference is actually going to make. The Troika might be gone, but the Troika policies will remain in place. And I think the fact that we won't have a credit line, you know, it's a political gamble, and a lot of things do have to go right, as Ingrid said, in terms of growth, in terms of tax revenues coming in on target, in terms of the banks not needing any more funding to remain solvent. So I think a lot of things have to go right if the government are going to get any political capital out of this.
Aileen Hickey, Jim Power and Ingrid Miley heard on The Gathering yesterday.
Playback on RTÉ Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
Piers Morgan has just published yet another volume of his diaries, his fourth. Piers used to straddle the world of British hot gossip and political intrigue as the tabloid editor of the Daily Mirror. But since his sacking after publishing fake photographs, allegedly showing Iraqi prisoners being abused by British soldiers, he's moved to the States, where he now presides over the hugely influential Piers Morgan Live on CNN television. His latest book is called Shooting Straight, Guns, Gays, God and George Clooney. And he was Marion Finucane's guest last Saturday.
You like winding people up. I thought it was very interesting that Jeremy Clarkson has decked you at least three times.
Well, he didn't deck me, because that would imply that I fell to the floor. He hit me three times in the head in a way that, I, as I said to him after the third blow, my three-year-old hits me harder than that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was a very, very limp-wristed, weak punch. So he needs to be careful, because he actually broke his finger hitting my head. So I think when you have that fact in the back of your mind, he wouldn't want to replay that incident too often, I shouldn't think.
And you and Jon Snow have had your spats.
Well, yeah, I talk in the book about when all the hacking scandal broke and people were desperate to try and embroil me in it. And Jon Snow actually tweeted that I had been suspended by CNN, and he loved it. He was tweeting, oh, the rise and fall of Piers Morgan, how glorious, blah, 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 blah. And there's only one problem. It was completely untrue, and it had been tweeted by a fictitious fake account. And so he then had to issue a grovelling apology, which was hugely entertaining from where I sat. But it just showed you that even the greats like Jon Snow, who are peerless exponents of broadcasting, who never make a mistake, occasionally, just occasionally, their halo can slip.
And Marion returned to the phone hacking scandal in Britain. Piers gave evidence to the Leveson inquiry and was memorably described by Lord Justice Leveson as utterly unpersuasive after he claimed to have no knowledge of alleged phone hacking at the Daily Mirror.
You're, first of all, a friend of Rebecca Brooks and very public about it, and Andy Coulson. You were involved in the Leveson inquiry.
Yeah.
And how was just the process of doing that? I got the impression you thought that, you know, that there was a natural bias against anybody that worked in tabloids as opposed to the Mother Teresa's that work in other forms of media.
Yeah, I just think that you could see all the broadsheet editors and executives all being treated with kid gloves. You could see that anyone who'd ever run a tabloid or worked at a high level of tabloid being monstered. And it was quite clear to me what the agenda was. And when you see people like Halo Hugh Grant, as I call him, or Saint Steve Coogan being pulled in as some great moral, ethical bastions of Britain who are going to dictate going forward how the British press should be regulated, I'm like, who appointed these guys? They're not elected. Who decided that a couple of B-movie actors were going to suddenly be determining freedom of the press? And my argument about the press is it's not perfect. And what was going on in that period covered by Leveson, a lot of it was wrong. And the law has been affected now in a way that perhaps it should have been before. And we will see the result of all the court cases, and I'm not going to prejudge any of them or pass comment on it. But certainly Britain, I would say, has more draconian laws if you're in the press than almost any other country in the world. And what worries me is that you're going to lead to a situation where politicians are promoted by actors are going to regulate the press and abandon centuries of a free press. And I just think that is a ridiculous state of affairs.
How did you react to the fact that Lord Leveson said of you that he described you as utterly unpersuasive?
Well, he's perfectly entitled to his opinion. You know, I had quite a hostile couple of hours in there, which I wasn't expecting anything different. But as I say, it came down to the agenda. You know, I mean, they were trying to get me to talk about things that happened in 2001, as if my memory of every moment, every lunch, everything else was going to be perfect after, you know, 12 years. I found some of it just vaguely ridiculous. But I tried to be as honest as I could, as best as I could from my memory. And if he took issue with some of it, that's his opinion. But I would take issue with his assessment.
Piers Morgan heard on the Marion Finucane Show, produced by Rachel Graham. Dublin writer Brendan Behan also spent time in the States, where his play, The Hostage, turned him into a celebrity. In fact, Norman Mailer said The Hostage made the beatnik movement, that's himself, Kerouac and Ginsberg, it made them all look respectable and uptown. A new play about Brendan's life there, written by his niece Janet Behan, with Adrian Dunbar playing Brendan, is at the Project Arts Centre in Dublin. Brendan Behan stayed initially at the storied Algonquin Hotel in New York, but later he moved to yet another famous haunt for artists and writers, the Chelsea Hotel, where he rubbed shoulders with the great and the good. One of his neighbours was the writer Arthur Miller.
Arthur Miller was across the hall, yeah.
He was trying to get over his breakup with Marilyn Monroe, and Brendan used to steal across the hall, and if he had to make any long-distance phone calls, he'd use Arthur Miller's phone.
I see, yes. And oh, yeah. Arthur Miller just grinned and bared it.
Yeah. I think he must have done.
Initially, Brendan Behan was on the dry in the States, but he fell off the wagon while in the Chelsea Hotel, as Adrian and Janet explained to John Murray.
The journalists used to pursue him across the place, and they tried to spike his drink lots of times. They tried to get him drunk consistently. Sure. And it was when he was about to go on a show called the Jack Parr Show, which was like kind of the late, late. And everybody kind of knew there was the big show in New York at the time. And Brent was, you know, and he was a shy person. And the alcohol did allow him to kind of relax. You know, that was the trick of it. And so he was asked on the Jack Parr Show, found himself very, very nervous before it. And thinking, like a lot of people do who are articulate, that he wouldn't have anything to say. He didn't know, you know. So anyway, he went and he had a couple of drinks, went on the Jack Parr Show drunk, and was headline news both sides of the Atlantic. That's how it happened to him, you know. That's how it all shifted and how he came off the wagon, as it were.
So the media fed.
They did. They
encouraged it. They didn't want Brendan being on the
No,
dry.
They didn't want the articulate, incisive, you know, Brendan Behan. They wanted the guy who was the roaring boy, really, you know, and that's what would make headlines for them, and that's why they pushed him, you know.
And also Brendan, and like a lot of people do who don't know any better and don't have anybody to look after of them, he had a very naive attitude towards publicity. Mm-hmm. And I think that he didn't realise, A, how damaging it was for his career as a serious writer, you know, which is something that he really, really wanted. Mm-hmm. But also how damaging it was for him psychologically to be paraded in the press as some kind of a buffoon. You know, I think at first he just thought all publicity... He said the only bad publicity is your obituary notice. You know, and I think at first, anyway, that was what he believed.
Janet Behan and Adrian Dunbar with John Murray. Last Sunday was Remembrance Sunday, which commemorates the laying down of arms at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. Well, to mark the end of the Great War, producer Cliannan Onlune dedicated an entire Sunday miscellany to the subject, and writer and former army officer Tom Clonan related a very personal story of a journey he took to France 96 years after one of his own family had perished in that horrific war.
I find the headstone on the left-hand side of the graveyard. Plot 1, row N, grave 11. Under the shade of an oak tree, Lieutenant Joseph Clonan, 36th Battalion, Australian Imperial Force. Date of death, November 10th, 1917. Clonan is an unusual surname, usually misspelled. I run my fingers over the carved stone lettering. There can be no mistake. Joseph is family. To the left of Joseph is a gravestone simply titled Soldier of the Great War. I say a prayer for him too. To Joseph's right lies Joseph Reichardt. The Iron Cross over his name indicates he was German. They lie here together, all three, lost boys, sleeping undisturbed for almost 100 years. I apologise to Joseph. I think I am the only Clonan to have visited his grave in all that time. We Clonans knew nothing about Joseph. Like many Irish families with loved ones who fought in the First World War, Joseph's story was buried, for whatever reasons, political, historical, cultural. Joseph's memory was erased.
Remembering the war dead, Tom Clonan, heard on Sunday Miscellany. Well, there are few survivors from the Second World War, and those who are alive are in their late 80s or early 90s. This was what motivated RTÉ documentary maker Donal Byrne and reporter Brian Dobson to interview some 20 veterans for the television programme Witnesses to War.
Each year there are fewer and fewer of them left who can tell their story. So Donal and I decided that really it was time for us to try and capture on camera the remarkable stories of these men and women, these Irish men and women, all of whom were volunteers. The Second World War was a great conscript war, the conscripted armies of America and Russia and Britain and France and Italy. But the Irish men and women who went as volunteers, which in itself is quite remarkable.
What about the numbers, Brian?
Well, we don't really know. I suppose because maybe people didn't always give their home address here in Ireland when they signed up. They were travelling to Belfast or the UK to enlist. Figures of 50,000 to 60,000 participants from the Republic of Ireland would be the kind of order of magnitude that I think a lot of people would accept. And in terms of casualties, maybe 7,000 to 9,000 who made the supreme sacrifice, who lost their lives.
Albert Sutton was only 19. He was unemployed with no hope of a job, living with his parents and fed up walking the streets. So he went to Belfast to the recruiting officer to enlist in the Royal Air Force as a flight mechanic. His squadron helped to liberate some of the Nazi concentration camps at the end of the war, and he told Sean O'Rourke about being in a convoy of soldiers as they entered Bergen-Belsen.
Is it true that you were one of the first into Bergen-Belsen there?
Ah, yes, that came at the end of my service there. The war was finished then, and I was sent up to the British Army of Occupation in Germany. And while we were up there, I heard a British officer coming in. He had a khaki uniform. We all had blue. And I heard him saying, "Quick, quick, we need men. I think I've found something down here. I've information there's a camp and I need some armed men now." And so we raked in about 25 of us. We had some machine guns then. They were called Sten guns. Very effective. And we went down in two lorries. And when we arrived, it was Belsen. And I never saw anything like it. There was a fence, electrified fence all around it. And there was bits of bodies and skeletons on the fence. And I said to somebody, "Oh, were they trying to escape?" "Well, in a way," he said, They were trying to commit suicide, and they were committing suicide. This is the poor people. They were standing about in little groups, mostly women, and they were all Jews, foreign Jews, and it was difficult to talk to them. But I did talk to one lady, and she said, yes, she said, the Germans told us if we got on this train that it would take us to our country and they were going to repatriate us. And when we arrived at this station, she said, the woman next to me realised what was happening and she grabbed the pistol from the guard and shot him dead. And that was the worst thing that could have happened because half the people on the train were murdered before they even got off the train.
World War II survivor Albert Sutton, who featured in Donal Byrne's documentary Witnesses to War. Well, the Irish Tatler Women of the Year Awards is the brainchild of broadcaster and publisher Nora Casey, and this year raised money for Barrettstown. Among the recipients presented with awards by Tatler editor Jesse Collins were Ombudsman Emily O'Reilly, the Deputy Commissioner of An Garda Síochána Noreen O'Sullivan, journalist Kitty Holland and soprano Céline Byrne. Always a star here on RTÉ Radio. The glorious voice of Céline Byrne. Corinne Mannion runs the Ashford Manor Guest House in Galway, and over the years she's had many requests from guests when they book in, maybe an extra bed or a cot in the room. But this week she got a very unusual request, as she told John Murray.
I was at my computer writing in my reservations and I got a special request and it stated, please could you place a photograph of Marty Morrissey beside my bedside?
Ah, go away. Yes.
I looked at it and I said, is this for real? What should I do about this? So I decided I would call the booker.
I see.
And I called Danielle and I said, hello. And I said, my name is Corinne Mannion from Ashford Manor in Galway. And I see you have a special request here. And she stated, yes, I'd like a photograph of Marty Morrissey beside my bedside.
Okay.
And I just started to laugh. And I said, are you for real? And she said, yes, I am. So the two of us roared laughing.
I see.
And she said, I really did it for a joke. And I screamed laughing back at her. And I said, well, thank you for giving me such a good laugh today.
So John decided to ring Danielle.
So you went to bed last night looking at Marty Morrissey?
I did indeed, and God bless him, he brought me good luck. I had an interview yesterday and it went really well, so
right.
he's some boy, so he is. A lot of people now would have just thought I was ridiculous. Well, in fairness, I am ridiculous, but I know he's such a good sense of humour now to do it, so fair play to him.
So, Danielle, what is it about Marty?
What isn't there about Marty? He's got it all, really.
Like?
He's a charismatic little devil, so he is, you
okay.
know?
Okay.
And he tweeted me and everything, so we've a bit of a thing going on now.
Oh, I see. Corinne, are you a big fan of Marty as well?
Absolutely, and even more so now.
I see. You probably have photographs of him in the breakfast
everywhere
room.
Everywhere now. We have one in every room now.
You may change the name of the guest house.
Even so, maybe so.
Well, actually, so. I believe now we're joined by Marty. Marty, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Go on, you can tell him directly now. What is it about Marty, Danielle?
Oh, Marty, you're just the man, CR. You're an idol, really.
Well, Danny,
oh my God.
What can I say except that I compliment you on your exquisite good taste? But I'm not too sure even I would want a photograph of my bedside locker of myself.
Oh, you see, you're modest as well. You just have it all, really. Oh, my God, you're an absolute star, Marty.
Marty Morrissey, not just wowing them in Croker, but now in the guest houses of Ireland. What a warrior. Life has been hectic too for athlete Rob Heffernan ever since he won the 50-kilometre walking race in Moscow last August. He and his wife Marion, who is also his manager, are expecting a baby next year, so Marion has put her career as a sprinter on hold, as I told Even the Huluan last Sunday.
Marion, what's next for you? You've got a baby coming along the way. What are you thinking about?
Nurseries now is the last couple of weeks. We're getting the attic converted because we've no room. So it's home improvements for the next month anyway, and just trying to decorate. Decorating around it. But another big challenge for us now is, like, in January when the baby does come, we'll have to juggle around things so that Rob can train as well. And it's with babies, you can't plan.
How's that going to impact the training? Sleepless nights, getting bottles?
Rob is after hooking himself up with a man cave. We got him. We got a kind of a Scandinavian log. Well, it's not a log cabin, but it's like a shed, a glorified shed.
It's a log cabin, it's a wooden
and,
house.
He's after putting carpet in there, and he's got a corner suite and a television. So
where is that?
It's in the back garden.
It's 6 metres by 5 metres. Yeah.
So
it's a
you're
castle.
Going to move out of the house.
So if things
baby
get really,
comes.
Really hard, I'm going to be left in the front room with the baby, and Rob will be out in the man cave.
No, it's not. This is very harsh.
Rob, what are you planning towards then? What is next for you that you're going to have to go and live in the man cave back in the garden?
I like being realistic, and this has been realistic, and Marion knows this, and I know everybody in the country saying, oh, wait until the baby comes out. But if I can't sleep, and in January I'm training very, very hard, like I'm doing like 100 miles a week in January, and my January's getting ready for February, and if I don't do January, I can't do February, and then I kind of miss March. So they're all stepping stones. So if I miss one of them blocks, it has it's implications on the whole year. Mm-hmm. Marion understands I might get an altitude tent for the log cabin because I'd usually go away training in January for a couple of weeks or in December, but no, because I'm not going to, I have to make that training environment at home because it's still work. But I think we'll be less busy because I think people will understand that we have a baby. And then all my extra time will be with Mara and the baby. Like, so it's, I think we'll be less busy.
Evie Nihuluan and guests from Evie and Company, produced by Eileen Herron. The documentary on One, Pregnant on My Lunch Break, told the story of Angela, a solicitor in her late 30s who always wanted a baby, but because she hadn't met the love of her life, she took an alternative route to motherhood through sperm donation. Her son was conceived on her lunch break from a man she'd never met, and the artificial insemination worked first time. In this extract, she brings up the subject with her 78-year-old father, a widower living in rural Tipperary.
So I was talking to him anyway, very casually on the phone, and I just said, he was talking about people that he knew who was trying to have children, and I said, oh, right. I said, God, I wonder how that'll work out. They were trying IVF, and I said, you know, I might see how they get on. And I said, that's something I might try. I said, you know, like the AI man, and being from the country, he would know what the AI man is. And so when I compared it, I suppose, to the old farming business, I guess he probably put it in perspective and he probably understood immediately what I meant. But at the same time, I was like, does he get it though? Because I said it so quickly and so, you know, it was in conversation on the phone. I said, so I might try that, you know. You can have in the AI man, like you can. And he said, yeah, right, okay. And then he goes, sure, why wouldn't you? Sure, what? You know, I said, well, like, Daddy, I'm getting older and I haven't really met anyone. I said, and he said, well, I think that'd be a good thing to do. Sure, why wouldn't you? And I just went, okay, this is all going very well. And I just didn't go on about it then. I left and I said, yeah, it's just something I think about. And at the time, I don't think he was feeling great. And he was saying something like, oh, you know, oh, I'll be long gone before there's any grandchildren and all that. And I was like, well, you'd never know. I said, just, you never know what's around the corner. So don't be giving up just yet. And I left it at that. And then that was it. And I just knew from that conversation that he would be fine. He'd be grand and he'd be delighted.
I can't remember what I said to her, but it wasn't bad anyway. A bit surprised, but sure. I was delighted for her, actually, that she'd have something to work for. Either work and be gone astray, like, after to share it out with another someone else. Anyway, it's good anyway, I think, you know. just something to be looking forward to.
Angela herself was adopted, and having a baby was important to her. And the good news is that her little boy weighed in at a healthy 7 pounds, 12 ounces, from the documentary on One.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
It's almost 60 years since the evacuation of the Great Blasket Island off the Kerry coast. On the history show, Colette Kinsler remembered times past with 93-year-old Mike Carney, one of the last residents who now lives in the United States. Mike says life was tough and often dangerous for the islanders.
The islanders made everything themselves, houses, furniture, musical instruments and clothes. And when it came to religion, the driving force behind do-it-yourself services was a famous woman. Remember Peg Sayers?
Oh my God, she used to say the rosary every Sunday. We used to have to kneel down on the cement floor and listen to her all day, praying for everybody in the island, praying for everybody in Dunquin, praying for everybody in Hartford, Connecticut, praying for everybody in Springfield, Massachusetts. Oh my God. We knew more about America than we did about Ireland, because our relatives were in America and they used to send home parcels.
The parcels were often filled with exotic gifts and clothes for the family.
Especially the women, you know, on the island. They used to wear the beautiful, colourful skirts and blouses. You could see them coming. And of course, sometimes there was a few dollars. And it enticed us to think that America must be a great country.
And compared to what they had on the island, America was a great country. Many of the young people wanted more than the island could offer, so they headed west to Boston and Massachusetts. Micheál was the first of his family to leave, and his father cried.
And he said to me the day I was leaving, "I hate to see you going, and whatever you say, and whatever you do, make sure you do it right." That has stayed with me.
And Mike Carney's memoir of his time on the island has recently been published by Collins Press. It's called From the Great Blasket to America. That was from the History Show last Sunday, produced by Yeti Redmond. Well, Morning Ireland reporter Cian McCormack visited a musical memory project in Dublin this week. The idea is to help people cope with dementia.
Shake out the knees and the hips and the bums and the tummies.
This project, Musical Memories, is designed specially for older people with dementia.
One, two, three.
The idea is simple. It's singing for the brain.
Catch a falling star and catch a falling star.
Music picked by the group provides cognitive stimulation. It reminds everyone of times past, musical director Gráinne O'Grady.
A lot of the research would show that music can help with things like memory, speech, you know, if somebody's having difficulties with speech, recognition of words, you know, mental health.
Okay, can everyone get that note? Right, two,
What's more important is the chance for those involved to meet up and have a nice time. Nuala comes to Dean's Grange with her husband Ambrose every Thursday.
I have a social life now through Ambrose and his condition. And sociability with Ambrose's condition is very important.
In his 80s, Ambrose has Alzheimer's.
You know, you're going to fade into the wallpaper if you stay at home. Just doing nothing or just doing a bit of gardening. But this interaction with people is very important for your mental and physical well-being.
The good thing about this is that people are bringing in songs, songs maybe from school that they sang years and years ago.
Indeed. And suddenly the memories light up again and they say, I remember that. And so it's in fact, apart from the singing, It's a memory lesson of how far back you can go to when it sang that for us and where it was, you know. So from that point of view, it's memories included.
Cian McCormack reporting for Morning Ireland. Well, I hope you'll stay tuned for George Lee. He'll be here after the 10 o'clock news with the business. But I leave you now with the song I heard on the Colm Hayes show on 2FM as part of their Cycle Against Suicide campaign. It's called Simple Things. Gurama go vasur goluther, tasulam gurwanshiv saltas glor, agis gmeshivlum takan amakena an tachtan shahagin, gajishen, gajeshib slan.
When all your inventions are breaking your heart, the whip cracks and wolf packs have torn you apart,
will you come see me, darling? Won't you explain? 'Cause there's nothing to cry for and nothing to gain.
So just remember the simple things instead.
And I'll keep my eye on the simple things instead.
This big got to your head. When the fate tells your girlfriends to leave you for dead,
this is not world war you found yourself in.